come on in.
And now, back to the Bill Frank Radio Show.
The kids love it.
And your host,
welcome to paradise,
Bill Frank.
Welcome back. This is Bill Frank, and you're listening to the Bill Frank Radio Show on KVTA News Talk 1520. I'm bringing fresh perspectives to Ventura and Santa Barbara counties. Every show has a theme, and today's theme is smorgasbord. Each of my guests has an interesting morsel of knowledge to share with us about his subject. My next guest has thoroughly investigated a story ripped from the headlines. No, not today's headlines, the headlines of 80 years ago. He's discovered the missing mastermind behind the Lindbergh baby kidnapping and tells all in his book, Cemetery John. Robert Zorn is a graduate of Duke University and the Wharton School of Business. His unique qualifications to tell this story is his relationship to his father, the late Eugene C. Zorn, Jr., a nationally respected economist, and the only person who ever witnessed the conspiracy behind the kidnapping. Joining us from the greater Dallas area. Hi, Bob. How are you today?
Great, Bill. Good to be with you.
Well, thank you so much for being our guest. I mean, a fascinating personal story because this involves your father directly. So tell us the story of how your father was an unwitting witness to history.
Well, my father, Eugene C. Zorn, Jr., grew up in a German neighborhood in the South Bronx, and he was born in 1916, passed away on Christmas Eve 2006. He was my greatest hero, my best friend. But my father, in the summer of 1931, he was a 15-year-old teenage boy, and he lived in a German neighborhood in the South Bronx, and three doors down from him was a kind of a strange man named John Knoll, a German immigrant and a deli clerk. And he had encouraged my father to take up stamp collecting. Well, one day in the summer of 31, John invited my father to go to Palisades Amusement Park in New Jersey, which in the middle of the Depression was like going to Disneyland for my dad. So, strangely, they had the world's largest saltwater swimming pool there, and strangely, John did not go swimming there that day, but after my dad showered and changed, they exited the park, and waiting for John at the top of the stairs that descended to the ferry dock, you had to ferry across the Hudson to get to New Jersey, and this park's at the top of the Palisades Cliffs, were two men waiting, John's younger brother, Walter, who another deli clerk, and my dad knew him as well, and then a third man who my father did not know. It was a man speaking in German, and the Knoll brothers were calling this fellow Bruno. And they were speaking in German in front of my dad, but my dad could not speak German. John knew this. My grandparents had been born in the States. So they felt comfortable speaking in German in front of my dad, and so John and Walter Knoll were speaking to this guy, Bruno, and they were talking about a town called Englewood. And then suddenly John told my father, "Gene, you go home alone." And for my dad, it was kind of a mild childhood trauma. He was all of 15 years old, 5 feet tall, blind in one eye, and, you know, he had been taken all the way to New Jersey from the Bronx by this fellow. He'd never been to Jersey before, but heeding John's instructions, went back to the Bronx and had, you know, watched John, Walter, and Bruno head off together. Well, you fast forward to 1963. By this time, my dad is a 47-year-old, nationally respected economist, and he walks into his Dallas barber shop and reaches for a magazine and grabs this magazine called True. And in it was an article about the Lindbergh kidnapping, which had taken place when my dad was actually 16 years old. And, of course, like everybody in the world, my dad knew about the kidnapping, but he wasn't really, at the time, interested in the details. He was more interested in the New York Yankees and his hero, Lou Gehrig, and his paper route and trying to become the first kid in his family to go to college. So, anyway, my dad's reading this article, and the gist of it was that Bruno Hauptmann, the man who went to the electric chair for the crime, for the murder of the Lindbergh baby, he went closed-mouthed to the electric chair in 1936, had accomplices who would escape justice. And at this point, this is only 31 years after the kidnapping, these fellows could still be on the loose. Well, my dad's reading about, well, I didn't know that, about the Lindberghs. Hey, they lived in Englewood. And he's reading about the existence of a kidnapper calling himself John, who had collected a $50,000 ransom at a Bronx cemetery and became known as the mysterious Cemetery John figure in the case. Hence the title of my book.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, my dad, then all of a sudden, you think about my father, who was an economist, who was trained to take bits of data and shards of information and form patterns in his mind, and suddenly his mind went into high gear, and he all of a sudden he remembered that meeting in 1931 when a man named John was talking to a guy named Bruno about a town, upscale New Jersey town located 4 miles from the Palisades Park called Englewood, and that John had had to send my dad home alone. Well, my dad further researched the case and came to conclude that this Bruno was indeed Bruno Hauptmann, the man who had gone to the electric chair for the Lindbergh kidnapping, and that John Knoll was indeed Cemetery John.
You
get into it, and since my father's death on Christmas Eve 2006, I've spent 3 years, probably 8 to 10 hours a day, crisscrossing the globe in search of the truth, crisscrossing the states in Germany in search of the truth. And when I first found a photograph of John Knoll, I placed it next to a police sketch done in 1932 of Cemetery John. Not only is that an identical likeness, but the physical description of Cemetery John matches that of John Knoll right down to a deformed left thumb.
It's an amazing coincidence. My guest is Robert Zorn, who's the author of the book Cemetery John, The Undiscovered Mastermind of the Lindbergh Kidnapping. And I guess, Bob, my first question is, okay, your dad may not have recognized it at the time, but this was the crime of the century. It was splashed all across the newspapers. It was on the radio everywhere. And a man or any person living in 1931-32 would have known about this, would have seen maybe pictures of Bruno Hauptmann before there. Didn't your dad connect the dots and see these pictures of Bruno Hauptmann and say, hey, isn't that the same guy?
Actually, Hauptmann wasn't caught until 2.5 years after the crime took place. This is 1934, and at which point my dad was already, you know, studying in college. And, you know, it didn't register. Again, this guy, fellow John Knoll, was a psychopath. And what these guys do is this guy was actually grooming my father to be the archivist of his great crime for history, as the criminal profilers have taught me, and the academic researchers of psychopathic personality. He was embedding clues in my father, and he was giving my father, 3 weeks after the ransom was paid, he was giving my dad Lindbergh stamps and Lindbergh commemorative covers commemorating the 5-year anniversary of the flight to Paris. But this fellow was so nice to my father, and he was so kind, you know, that this is... He was giving my dad things, taking him places. It's a complete disconnect, and that's what these psychopaths do. They nurture young kids, and they're able to use these people for their evil purposes.
Okay, my guest is Robert Zorn, author of the book Cemetery John. So, you mentioned in an earlier answer that Hauptmann went to his grave, died at the electrical chair, did not divulge the name of any of accomplices to the crime. You know, who says there's no honor among thieves? I find it hard to believe, though, that Hauptmann wouldn't give up the names of his accomplices, maybe to receive a lesser sentence or something like that. What did your research reveal about Hauptmann's maintaining his silence all the way to his death?
Well, that is more a matter of trying to figure out what was in his mind. Now, you figure that when he was a common criminal, he was not a mastermind type. He was not the type that would have wanted to steal this baby and show the world that he was as powerful as Lindbergh, which was John Knoll's objective in this crime. But Hauptmann had told his wife from the outset that he was framed. And it was very, very clear from the evidence, including a rail 16 from a kidnap ladder that he had built that had matched a piece of wood from his attic floorboard, that he was involved in this thing. There was no doubt about that. But he had always been able to wiggle his way out of every jam that he had gotten to. He was a fugitive from justice when he came to the States in 1923. And then he's convicted of this crime. Now, when he's convicted, he's ushered into the New Jersey State Prison, where he's immediately booed, hissed, and jeered at by hundreds of inmates taking their midday meal. We all know where a pedophile or a child murderer is in the pecking order in prisons and what happens when other prisoners get their hands on him. Well, add to that he's German and there's still anti-German sentiment, and he's kidnapped the most famous and beloved baby in the world. So you can imagine what life would have been like for him in the prison, not to mention the fact that he would have then had to go back to his wife and say, oh, by the way, Anna, I've been lying to you for the last year and a half, and he would have lost her favor and the favor of the entire German-American community. And perhaps better just to go to the electric chair and allow his family and the German-American community to believe that he had been unjustly convicted.
Wow. I mean, that is truly taking one for the team. My guest is Robert Zorn. So, Bob, you've already said that it's pretty clear that Bruno Hauptmann did not act alone. What other evidence do you have that he did not act by himself?
Well, there were the logistics of the crime scene. You cannot have gone up and down that ladder and brought the baby out and so forth. That was just impossible. There were two sets of footprints leading from the kidnap ladder back toward where the getaway car was. There were lookouts at the two cemeteries where the ransom negotiations took place. It was very, very clear. The evidence is fascinating, and the evidence that points to John Knoll, not only the police sketch and the deformed thumb that matched that of the physical description of John of Cemetery John, but also I've done handwriting analysis, high-tech handwriting analysis software that was used and applied to known samples of John Knoll's handwriting that shows a 95% probability that he indeed wrote the ransom envelopes. Not only that, but just 3 weeks before Hauptmann went on trial for murder in New Jersey, John Knoll, this German deli clerk who, in the middle of the Depression, spent the equivalent of 70 months' rent to buy two first-class round-trip tickets on the luxury liner SS Manhattan. I have a photograph of him, a dated photograph, but 3 weeks before Hauptmann goes on trial. And then literally the very day of Hauptmann's conviction, February 13th, 1935, once John Knoll realizes that his accomplice and recruit Hauptmann had not ratted him out on the witness stand, that's the very day that John Knoll leaves Europe to come back to the States. And I've shown this evidence to top New Jersey prosecutors, including former governor, New Jersey Governor Brendan Byrne, to literally the top FBI profilers in history, including John Douglas, who founded and ran the behavioral science unit for 25 years, but even members of John Knoll's own family, with whom I've actually become very dear friends, even a niece of his, after seeing this evidence, said, "Oh, Bob, you must write this book. The truth must come out. Uncle John should have done the right thing and turned himself in."
My guest is Robert Zorn, author of the book Cemetery John, The Undiscovered Mastermind of the Lindbergh Kidnapping. And there's an old expression, Bob, follow the money. And in this particular case with the Lindbergh kidnapping, there was a ransom of $50,000 that was paid at the cemetery, as you pointed out. Only a third of the ransom money was found, coincidentally, in Hauptmann's garage, Bruno Hauptmann's garage. What happened to the other two-thirds, do you think? And more to the point, you know, here's where John Knoll spent the money on a trip back to Germany, first class, which was very expensive at that time. But what other signs of excess did he exhibit where he might have been flaunting or spending the ransom money that he had collected?
Well, for one thing, my father, the future economist, had a terrific sense of money matters, even as a teenage boy. And my dad noticed that 3 weeks after the ransom was paid, John Knoll began buying up entire expensive collections of stamps, going to Manhattan and buying them from collectors, and became incredibly generous to my dad in terms of stamps and collectibles that he gave him. In fact, this one that has a Lindbergh stamp that was actually carried over on the Graf Zeppelin, it instantly became my father's most valuable possession in life. And not only that, but in other instances, there were ransom bills that were recovered, and some of them were detected to have had animal fat stains on them. And again, this was done by a leading chemist of the day. And of course, John Knoll and his brother Walter were deli clerks. They were handling meat all the time. So that's another example. And then somehow, John Knoll went from becoming deli clerk to the owner of multiple delicatessens and stores.
Very interesting. My guest is Robert Zorn. So, Bob, This is one theory, and it is a very good theory supported by a lot of evidence, but there are other theories out there to explain the kidnapping and the murder of Charlie Lindbergh, the son of Charles Lindbergh and Anne Morrow Lindbergh. One of the more controversial theories is that Charlie Lindbergh was actually killed by his own father, that Charles didn't want Charlie to be a mama's boy and accidentally killed him while trying to prove a point. Why is this theory and the other theories that are out there less credible than the one you put forth?
Well, first of all, nobody endorses these books. I mean, I've got former members, the people that have lived in the White House, governor's mansions, the top FBI profilers, and a whole list of forensic scientists that have endorsed my work, and the general consensus is case closed. But this one about Lindbergh himself is just particularly heartbreaking because Anne Morrow Lindbergh was still alive at the time. And it's all groundless speculation, Bill, this type of thing. And Lindbergh was a meticulous planner. It was very clear that some of the wood from the kidnap ladder came from Hauptmann's attic floorboard. And it just these things just don't meet up with any level of scrutiny, and they're immediately disproved. I could go on and on, but I could spend hours talking about these.
Well, you certainly are an expert. My guest is Robert Zorn, author of the book Cemetery John. So, Bob, what's it going to take to definitively solve the Lindbergh kidnapping case? Will your book close the book, as it were, on this case?
Well, I've had New Jersey prosecutors, former New Jersey prosecutors that are intimately familiar with the case, say, yes, it already has.
Wow.
It already has. And these people that occupy the White House and the governor's mansions and the top FBI profilers, they don't lend their name cavalierly to theories and to books. They do so. These people are logic machines, and they examine facts and evidence, and there is just too much compelling evidence that points squarely at John Knowlton. I must add that when I embarked on this journey, that I told my dad I would tell his story, but I vowed that if I ever found one piece of evidence that conflicted with my dad's theory and disproved it, that would be the end of it for me. Faithfulness to my father did not require me to prove that John Knoll committed this terrible crime. Faithfulness to my father required me to get as close as I possibly could to the truth, and that's what I've sought out to do. And when I've shown this evidence to the profilers and the forensic scientists and the prosecutors and others, they all reach the same they all seem to reach the same conclusion. John Douglas, who is the model of the Jack Crawford character in The Silence of the Lambs and ran the behavioral science unit for 25 years, immediately after examining this evidence in a six-hour initial meeting, said John Knoll is the best suspect in 80 years. If I had been advising the police, I'd have told them to put him right on the front burner. He said, I will write the foreword to your book. Let's do a documentary on this. And we've since filmed a NOVA documentary. And that's the kind of reaction you get. And to my knowledge, my book is the first in 20 years since John Douglas became famous that he has lent his name to.
Wow, what a ringing endorsement. My guest has been Robert Zorn, author of the book Cemetery John, The Uncovered Mastermind of the Lindbergh Kidnapping. And clearly you've piqued the interest of some of my listeners out there, Bob. If they want to learn more about you, learn more about the book, where would you direct them to go on the internet?
Well, you can go to cemeteryjohn.com. I have a Facebook page, Cemetery John, just Googling this, you'll see Wall Street Journal book reviews and many others. This story made the front page of the Philadelphia Inquirer as a news story the other day. It's gotten tremendous press all across the world, which would have gratified my father. My father so deeply wanted justice to be done in this case. He felt that justice was not served. My dad had more than his own share of fame and attention, and he was a very humble man. But it hurt him deeply that this beautiful boy, 20 months old, was kidnapped and murdered, and that only one man who was responsible for this crime went to the electric chair while his two accomplices, John and Walter Knoll, escaped justice and lived the rest of their lives in freedom. And Anne Morrow Lindbergh, who lost her beloved firstborn son at age 26, lived till age 94, 69 years, She spent not a day went by when she said, oh my goodness, what could Charles and I have done to have prevented this horrible crime from this happening to our boy? And indeed, Lindbergh himself this boy would have been the love of his life for the rest of his life. It is absolutely, although he's a very stoic guy, this absolutely was crushing to him as well.
It absolutely was. Thank you, Bob, for being my special guest here on The Bill Frank Show. We'll talk to you down the road.
Great. Thanks so much, Bill. Great to be with you.
Great. Thank you.